In this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska.
The Admiral assured Congressman Young that he would never let anything bad happen out in Prince William Sound.
Pat Levy predicts the worst man-made disaster that may ever hit Alaska. And Chris Wolinski's Leave No Trace approach to nature ends up leaving a bit of a trace.
The flames are coming, and they're coming fast. And I'm thinking, it's coming in too fast. We're not going to have enough time.
Man-made disasters. Up next on Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, I'm Rob Prince. Nature can throw a lot at you up in Alaska. We've seen just about everything, from earthquakes and tsunamis to insane cold temperatures, wind, and ice storms. As brutal as those experiences can be, for many Alaskans, what hurts their hearts even more is when we, as humans, accidentally create our own disasters, and none is more notorious than the Exxon Valdez oil spill. On March 24, 1989, the oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground in Prince William Sound, spilling 11 million gallons of oil. At least one man feared the spill could happen before it did and tried to alert the administration. Pat Levy worked with the radar used to navigate the tankers through Prince William Sound, and Dark Winter Nights host Brittany Carnes spoke with him about that experience at our February 2024 live event in Fairbanks.
I came up to Alaska on a Coast Guard C-130 when I was in the Coast Guard. And so I flew into Valdez. The airplane taxied up to the terminal, and I was bringing a communications station up to Valdez. And so I backed it off the airplane, and as soon as I hit the ice, I jackknifed the whole assembly. And as they were putting the ramp up on the airplane, I could see that they were all laughing at me and waving goodbye. And boy, it was pretty embarrassing. But I was 21 years old, and so I drove over to the fence to get out of the airport there, and a guy came out, let me out of the gate, and I rolled the window down, and I said, which way is town? And he said, well, you go down this road and you make a right at the yellow flashing light and you can't miss it. And so I said, well, what happens if I drive past it? And he said, well, you can't. Welcome to Alaska. And so that was how I got to Alaska. And so what we were doing was we were bringing a communications station that I was bringing up, and there was a radar trailer that was coming over from Groton, Connecticut, and then they were going to bring this travel trailer out. We're going out into Prince William Sound, where it leads into Port Valdez. That area is called the Narrows, and so. There's a little point of land out in the Narrows called Potato Point. And so that's where we're going to take all these trailers to. And so I found out that I was there early by like 2 to 3 weeks. The radar trailer hadn't shown up yet. So they put me to work at the new vessel traffic center that they were building. And so while I was there, I found out there were like 10,000 people over at the oil terminal facility over there working on it, you know, to get it built. And anyway, they were making a whole lot of money, and there was a whole lot of money in Valdez, and I wasn't making any of it. I think I made some like $7,200 that year or something like that. But one day, the radar trailer arrived, and they told us to go down to the small boat harbor, and they loaded us all up on this huge landing craft. It was pretty cool. And they also put two front loaders on there, too. And so we got underway out to Potato Point, and when they arrived at, you know, this big landing craft, just like World War II, the finest of D-Day movies, you know, they hit the beach and the front door comes down and these two front loaders drive out and they make a road up to the top of Potato Point, and they come back, they grab our trailers, take those up there, and then they went back and loaded up on the landing craft and left us there when the tide came in, and they took off. And so we started this temporary radar site out at Potato Point. And during the day, I'd kind of wander around out in the wilds of Alaska. And at night, I'd try to talk to my buddies down off of San Francisco flying missions there at the air station there. But I had never seen so much snow before. This was during the wintertime, and it was pretty crazy.
So how long were you stationed there at Potato Point?
Well, originally this trip was supposed to take a week, but I ended up being there in Alaska for like a month. But finally, the big event happened where the first tanker came in to Prince William Sound, and you know, they had never tested this to see if a tanker could come in, go through the narrows, and then miss Middle Rock, kind of out in the middle there, and turn and make it into Port Valdez and go to the oil terminal. And that's why the Coast Guard was there to make sure that this came off with no hitches. And it did. I was able to talk to the Coast Guard Vessel Traffic Center with my radio station, and then also talk with the vessel as it came through. Also, it was a success. I went back to San Francisco, and I had this great Alaskan adventure under my belt, and you know, spent a little bit more time in the Coast Guard and got out and went to school on the GI Bill and started really starving to death, and realized that I really needed to get a job. So I opened up the newspaper and saw that there were some radio tech jobs in Panama. And so I applied for that, got an interview, and I thought, all right, I'm going to Panama. And went in there, and the guy told me right away that the jobs in Panama had fallen through, and they weren't available. And he said, but we're always looking for techs. And so we have some openings in other places. And he said, well, we have an opening at a Coast Guard Vessel Traffic Center up in Valdez, Alaska. And I went, wow. When I was in the Coast Guard, and I actually helped start that vessel traffic center there. And he said, well, son, do you know how to work on radar? And I said, well, yes, I've actually worked on a lot of aircraft radars. And he said, well, would you like to go back to Valdez? And I went, yeah, I do. I want to go back to Valdez. And that was it. I worked on, there were two radar sites now in that the Vessel Traffic Center had. One of them was in the small boat harbor, and that monitored the Alyeska oil terminal facility over there in the port. And then the other one was a newer, bigger radar that was out at Potato Point. Out there, they could monitor the tanker one-way zone through the narrows and all the way out through the arm. And we used to monitor ice out in the end of the arm out there that was coming out from Columbia Glacier. It was pretty cool.
Was there ever a close call?
Yeah, in fact, in 1980, not too long after I got there, during a winter storm, the tanker that was actually named Prince William Sound lost power in a storm out in Prince William Sound, and so it was, the engines weren't working on it, and the storm was blowing it towards Naked Island, and it was fully loaded with crude oil. And out that far, we couldn't see it on our radar system. And so tugs, since it was in a storm, tugs couldn't get lines onto the vessel and get it under tow. And it was estimated that the Prince William Sound, the tanker Prince William Sound, came within 30 minutes of running aground on Naked Island out there in Prince William Sound. And we were really happy when it actually regained power on its own. And we felt like we had really dodged a big bullet there, and so it didn't run aground, which was good. So then after about 5 years, word came down that the Coast Guard was going to terminate that cushy radar contract that I worked on, and what they were going to do instead was they were going to put up a smaller, a cheaper, lower power, less resolution radar that their own Coast Guard techs could work on. Well, I thought this was a huge mistake, and so I decided to speak out. I wrote letters to my legislators at the time. That was Ted Stevens and Frank Murkowski and Congressman Don Young. And in the letters, I mentioned about that tanker mishap, in 1980 with the tanker Prince William Sound. And I also told them that I thought that, putting in a lower power, less resolution radar was actually a downgrade to the system, and that something like this could really cause a disaster to happen in Prince William Sound. Well, so Congressman Young actually contacted the commandant of the Coast Guard and asked him, you know, about this downgrade to the system there. And the admiral assured Congressman Young that he would never let anything bad happen out in Prince William Sound. And yeah, unfortunately, this is kind of like a Titanic story, and we all know really what happened, that in March of 1989, which was 5 years after I'd lost my job, the tanker Exxon Valdez was fully loaded with crude oil, and third mate Cousins was in control of the bridge on the vessel, and he called up the vessel traffic center and requested permission to deviate from the outbound traffic lane due to ice in the traffic lane. As we all know too, Captain Hazelwood was drunk and asleep down in his bunk, and the vessel traffic watchstander, who was now just a single civilian there, which the Coast Guard had further downgraded the vessel traffic center, called up the Exxon Valdez and gave them permission to deviate out of that outbound traffic lane. And then using the new low-power radar, he quickly lost contact with the Exxon Valdez. And so the 80-something foot high chunk of steel, less than 13 miles from Potato Point, ran aground on Bligh Reef. We had that tanker disaster that the admiral had assured Congressman Young that he would never let anything bad happen.
So this is 5 years from when you lost your job. Where were you living now, and how did you...
I was here. I was in Fairbanks. And in fact, I was up at UAF Yak Estates going to college. Well, and so that morning of the spill, the Alaska State Troopers called me up at my apartment, and which that was shocking in itself to be called up by the Alaska State Troopers. And and they informed me that there had been an accident in Prince William Sound. And they said that they understood that I knew something about the radar system in Valdez, and that they wanted to talk to me before CNN and French TV got a hold of me. And I was like, wow, what a thing to wake up to in the morning. So I went down to the Alaska State Trooper office here in Fairbanks, and the officer confided in me that he was used to actually interviewing criminals, and he didn't really know what to say to me. So I bled my heart out into his tape recorder, and you know, since he didn't really know what to ask me, then it was just kind of weird. After that, I made the front page of the Valdez Vanguard. The government knew about radar was the title of the story, and then a herd of attorneys grabbed me and sent me to Anchorage to do a deposition there. And when I arrived in Anchorage, one of the attorneys said, "Hey, why don't you meet me in the Captain Cook Hotel bar?" And I said, "Okay." And so I got there, and he was with somebody else. And the guy introduced himself really loudly as Captain Hazelwood's attorney. And I quickly like looked around the bar, and I said, "Hey, could you please not say Hazelwood's name again? Because I was worried we were going to get beat up." And but anyway, I was found out to my horror that I was actually supporting Hazelwood's case with the grounding of the Exxon Valdez and the spilling of 11 million gallons of oil. That was a little bit of a disappointment to me.
I think you're still a student at UAF.
Yeah, I was still a student at UAF, and I'm glad you said that too, because I just could not wait to get out of spring semester at UAF, you know, to go down to the spill. I think everybody else in Alaska was doing the same thing too, going down to work on the spill. My first job on the spill was, I was a night watchman at the sea otter pathology lab. And unfortunately, the sea otters were getting oiled and they were drowning. And so that was really a drag. Fortunately, that job was really short-lived, and I got hired by Vico as a radio tech to work at the Exxon Vico Valdez Dispatch Center. The Valdez Dispatch Center was out on the container dock in town that was union-controlled. And, you know, what we did was we were working where they built all the barges to go out to the task forces to work on the spill. And we kind of controlled all the traffic all over everywhere. At one point, Exxon sent me out to Sleepy Bay. And remember, the way the oil spill functioned was, you know, the Exxon Valdez ran aground on Rocky Point, released that 11 million gallons of oil, and then the oil slick kind of went around the sound. It went up Night Passage, hit Sleepy Bay, and then it left Prince William Sound out into the Gulf of Alaska and headed to Kodiak. Well, when I got to Sleepy Bay, it was really bad, really heavily oiled. They had backhoes down on the beach that were digging holes in the beach so that they could pump the oil out that was collecting in those holes. But God, it was really bad. But we did that. We cleaned up the sound, you know, as best we could. And you know, I'm proud to say that we did as much as we did. I think any oil that was removed was a good thing. Well, I was going to think if there's anybody out there, which I'm sure there are a lot of people here from Fairbanks that went down and worked on the spill. We really didn't get much of a thanking when we got back, but thank you very much for the work that you did out there too. But anyway, so, you know, after the spill, you know, they pretty much, what they did was in the winter there of 89, when the spill started winding down, we demobilized all the task forces, we tore them down, and everybody came back to Valdez and started dispersing back home. I went back to Fairbanks and tried to readjust after working on that. That was weird, working on the spill. But anyway, I had two wonderful daughters, Rachel and Sarah, and then my marriage fell apart. And, you know, I felt like I'd gone full circle, though, you know, from seeing the first tanker come into Prince William Sound to trying to stop a tanker disaster to actually working on the worst tanker disaster in U.S. history. And it was really kind of hard to wind down from that. But about 20 years ago from today, I went over to a friend of mine's house, Dick Flaherty. He had an every Thursday night barbecue. And one of my other friends came over, Ann Bibberman. Probably a lot of people know her too. But anyway, she brought in a bunch of new faces to Dick's that night. And I'll never forget that she came up to me and said, hey, Pat, this is Lori Neufeld. We just hired her at KUAC. Lori and I actually became quick friends after that and started dating. And then we got married 10 years ago. So that was pretty cool. But thank you, everybody.
Pat Levy, he shared that story at our February 2024 live event in Fairbanks. This is Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. I'm Rob Prince. Many people tried to pin the blame of the Valdez oil spill on one man, Captain Joseph Hazelwood. But hindsight has shown that there were failures at many levels that allowed it to happen. In our next much lighter story, all of the blame for this rather minor man-made disaster can safely be placed on one man. My longtime friend and Dark Winter Nights executive producer, Chris Swolinski, shared this story at our November 2022 live event in Fairbanks.
Cold Bay is at the tip of the Alaska Peninsula, the end of the line before the Aleutian Islands start. It's about 900 miles southwest of Fairbanks. It's really a spectacular place, the whole peninsula. It's dotted with active volcanoes. It's got these snow-capped mountains that run the length. It's teeming with wildlife, brown bear, caribou, and I mean, untold numbers of waterfowl. It's fantastic. The downside of the peninsula is the weather. The wind never seems to quit blowing. The rain never seems to stop falling. And when you're on the field, it's just brutal. It's a constant battle to keep your gear dry, to keep yourself dry, to keep the tents from blowing away. It's always work. This particular year, I was hired for a spring brown bear hunt, and it was May. There was two very different things this year. One is that it was sunny. I mean, like hot and sunny, blue skies every day. So sunny that most everybody in the field got sunburned. Nobody thought to bring sunscreen, and there's one store in Cold Bay. They didn't sell any because they never carried it. So Rod and I go about setting up camp, and one of the things I like to pay attention to, besides the tents, is where the latrine goes. There's going to be three of us, myself, Rod, and the client that hasn't showed up yet, and each of us are going to get their own latrine, which is just a hole in the ground. But they get theirs. You poop in yours. I use mine. Everybody's fine. The only thing that I ask you to do is, because things don't rot so well in Alaska so quickly, I like to burn my toilet paper. It's kind of my leave no trace thing. And I set the camp up about 200 yards inland. Perpendicular to the beach is a ridge and a 3 or 4 foot wide creek running parallel with the ridge into the ocean, where we get our fresh water from. And behind us is these rolling hills that go toward the mountains. And it's all this beautiful dry grass that's a little over your knees that's waving in the breeze, all of last year's grass. And there's plenty of country behind us. So the client, Jake, gets flown in. And it's very evident that, we can't walk very well. But that's all right. He explains his physical limitations. That's fine. We're a team. We're going to work together, do what it takes. We're not going to be able to climb any hills or hike any long distance that I'm used to, but that's okay. It's his hunt. And we got plenty of time, and look at this weather. I mean, what do I care? So fast forward, end of a couple of weeks, he is successful. It's the end of the hunt and actually the end of the season. And now we're waiting around for Richard, the outfitter, to fly in and check on us and start taking us out. Certainly there were satellite phones, radios, everything available. We just didn't have any. Maybe he's a tightwad or something. I don't know. He never gave us any. So during one of what would, possibly be one of my last trips, I had my lighter, and after I was done using the facilities, all finished here, and I took my Bic, and I had a pile of paper there that had been collecting. I wasn't really collecting it. And I flicked my Bic and torched it. Some flaming paper rolled off and caught the grass on fire. And like right now, it caught on fire. You know that flash paper, the magic show? It just took off. And I'm stomping around. I'm wearing hip boots. And I'm bouncing around, stomping on the fire. And like after about 30 seconds, I'm like, oh my God, I'm not catching up with this. And I don't know what, I'm not gaining on it. My stomach is in a knot. I'm just sick. And I need help, but if I yell for help, it's just going to totally expose my stupidity. So I just keep on stomping. I'm stomping away, and the flames, but when I look, the flames are going right toward the camp. The wind's blowing it toward camp, and I'm like, oh, man, I got to do something. So I yell out, Rod, I burned my toilet paper. And he's eager to help. He's always is, and he just didn't hesitate. He sees the situation. He grabbed a bucket, and he scooped some water out of that creek. Came running over. I'm still stomping away, and he sloshes it on the fire. And then he runs back, and I run back with him. I get a bucket. We both come out there and slosh. We're not gaining. It's going toward the camp, and the tactic changes. Now we're thinking, well, let's save the gear. So we take our water buckets, and we start pouring water around the tents. But the flames are coming, and they're coming fast. And I'm thinking, it's coming in too fast. We're not going to have enough time, and I don't know what to do. And it's like, Jake, God, what about Jake? And I did not say, we have this under control. He came out of his tent. We have it under control. I didn't say that. I said, head for the beach, which he did on his own accord as fast as he could walk. He ran for the beach, walked to the beach. Now we've come up with a different plan. Why don't we take our gear and get it across the creek? It's about 4 or 5 feet wide. Get it across the creek. Okay, we'll do that. So we're hauling everything across the water as fast as we can, but we're not gaining. And we just said, stuff it. And we pulled the tent stakes and just grabbed the tents like giant sacks and started dragging them across the tundra, across that water, across the 4 or 5 foot wide creek, dragged it over there hoping this is going to serve as a fire break. And we did. We made it. The fire just kind of, in a minute later, it came through and it just right through camp, just burned right through what was our camp. And then it just kept on going beyond down. And I'm just watching this and going, oh, I've never caused anything like this before. And it burned out in about 35, 45 minutes. It did burn out. As bad as it is, it could have been worse. That day, the wind was blowing from the mountains out toward the ocean. Any other day of the season, it had been blowing from the ocean toward the hills. It could have burned for miles, maybe into the trees. I don't know. But this would have been something they'd been calling smoke jumpers, a tundra fire. And even though in 5-6 weeks with the rain, it's gonna turn green again, nobody's ever going to know. Right now, I'm looking at like 40 acres of black. It's like, leave no trace. I'm so embarrassed. I'm mortified looking at this like, oh, my stomach is just turning. And it's not just what I've caused. I know that when word gets out back at main camp, all the other guides find out, they're going to tease me no end. I am just going to be beaten down and mocked, and rightfully so. I mean, I caused this. And now, the very next day, Richard did come flying in. And what it's obvious he's going to see what is obvious, that the terrain has changed a little bit. And so he kind of came down low, and he does a slow circle around, and the three of us came out. I made sure nobody waved to him or anything that he might indicate for distress. Yeah, we're okay. He sees us, three people, five tents, different spot. He landed, but the tide wasn't out all the way, and he couldn't land close to camp. He landed about a half mile away. Right, he ran after that airplane like it was like pizza delivery wagon, like he hadn't eaten for months. He went up there and like, oh, thanks, Rod. By the time I got to the airplane, he had already told Richard the story. The beating I was going to take was just beginning. So Richard lined us out for the next day, and the next following day did go off without a hitch. He came back in, flew Jake out, Rod out, and then the gear, flew everything out. I'm always the last person to clean up everything. I'm the last one. Get in the airplane. We take off. Kind of turned as we took off. We could see over this black. And if it looked ugly from the ground, I'm telling you, from the air, it was looked disastrous. It was horrible. We land. I unload the airplane. I start talking to the other guys, and they're telling me what happened in their camps, what they'd seen, who got what, and who got the best suntan. But nobody had talked about my little incident, and I didn't bring it up. And so I think, wow, I dodged a bullet. That's cool. That's great. After about a half hour of visiting with everybody, I went over to the main tent. Nobody was in the tent. As soon as I opened up the door, I walk in. I saw on the wall was this Newsweek magazine cover. And there's a photograph, and it's leaping vivid flames on the photograph. I'm like, Newsweek? God, how'd they find out? But when I got up closer upon inspection, I'm kind of looking. I go, it's Los Angeles. There's buildings in flames, cars overturned, chaos. But somebody had taken a Sharpie, and they'd written across the face of the magazine 4 of the 5 W's of journalism. Who? Chris Zwolinski. What? Burns 40 acres of wilderness. Where? Cold Bay, Alaska. Why? Because the LA Lakers won the national basketball championship. Thank you very much.
Chris Zwolinski. He shared that story at our November 2022 live event in Fairbanks. Thanks for listening to this edition of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Man-Made Disaster episode. Today's episode was edited by myself, Rob Prince. Story consultation by Lori Neufeld. Remember, these are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on Dark Winter Nights. I'm Rob Prince.